Well, turn with me again, please, to the passage that we read earlier on as we continue our studies in the life of Jacob. We come this evening to our second study, and you'll notice that we've missed out a chapter in Genesis. Last time we were in chapter 25, and this evening we're mainly, at least, in chapter 27. But that, of course, is because chapter 26 is simply about Isaac, and there's not really any mention at all of our man Jacob. And so I'd like us to look at this passage this evening under four headings. And first of all, an unwise man. An unwise man. In chapter 26, verse 34, to chapter 27, verse 4. And the unwise man to whom I'm referring is Isaac. And I think that we have two instances in these verses of Isaac being unwise. The first is in verse 34, where we read, When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, daughter of Elon the Hittite. Now you might be thinking, well, hang on a minute, how is that an instance of Isaac being unwise? He's not even mentioned there in that verse. But you see, that is precisely the point. That's the problem. Contrast this with the beginning of Genesis chapter 24. In those verses, we read this: Abraham was now old and well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed him in every way. He said to the chief servant in his household, the one in charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh. I want you to swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I am living, but will go to my country and my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac." And you see there then, Abraham's concern that Isaac shouldn't marry a Canaanite woman. So much so indeed that he makes his servant swear to him in the most solemn fashion that he will go to Abraham's own land and to Abraham's own people and will find there a wife, a suitable wife for Isaac. Well, why then, now a generation later, isn't Isaac doing the same thing for Esau? That's what you would expect. And yet, there's absolutely no indication of that whatsoever. It seems as though Isaac simply left Esau to get on with the business of marrying whomsoever he pleases. And so Esau, we're told, marries not only one Canaanite woman, but two Canaanite women. And we're told in verse 35 that they were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. And it raises the question, doesn't it? Why didn't Isaac do for Esau what his father Abraham had done for him a generation earlier? Why didn't Isaac intervene? Why didn't Isaac take his son Esau to one side? Why didn't he send him back off to his own people and his own land to get a suitable wife? Why did he just let Esau get on with finding a wife, or indeed wives, for himself? Well, of course, we don't know for sure. But I suspect it was simply sheer apathy. Simply sheer apathy. If Isaac had realized, of course, that he and Rebekah were going to go through great grief because of this, then yes, certainly he would have intervened. Then certainly he would have sent Esau off to find a suitable wife. But it seems as though Isaac simply never stopped to work through the implications of simply letting Esau get on with marrying whomsoever he pleased. He never asked the question, where is this going to lead? He never stopped to work through the implications of this. And you know, I think at the outset there this evening, there's a very instructive lesson for ourselves, because this is always a temptation. It's always a temptation simply to let things follow their own natural course, so to speak. Like Isaac did with Esau's marital prospects, without ever stopping and asking the question, hang on a minute, what are the implications of this? Perhaps this evening, you young people, you children, perhaps there is some area at school or some area in your studies, some area in your interests that you are particularly good at, you're particularly skilled at. Perhaps not yet, but in a few years' time, this will become very evident that there's a certain area in which you're particularly skilled, whether it be mathematics, whether it be business studies, whether it be sport, whether it be acting, whatever it might be. And you see, it may well be that that particular skill that you have, that will lead very naturally into some course beyond school, beyond your current studies. Some course at college, some course at university. And then it may well be that that course will lead very naturally on to some career beyond that. Now, of course, there's nothing necessarily wrong with all that. But the point is that you need to be thinking beforehand, at the very outset, what are the implications of this? What are the implications of me going down this path, following this particular line of education, this particular career? What will the implications be if I end up enmeshed in that particular career where this seems to be taking me? What will the implications be for my relationship with God? What will the implications be for my spiritual health? What will the implications be for my Christian service? What will the implications be? We need to be constantly asking the question. You might be someone this evening who is just beginning to become close to a member of the opposite sex, beginning to start a relationship with somebody. And it may be that at the moment you're enjoying the initial excitement, the initial buzz of that. And you're just adopting the attitude, well, we'll see how far this goes. We'll see how the relationship proceeds. But you see, you should be asking the question now. What are the implications of this? Suppose the relationship blossoms. Suppose we get engaged. Suppose we get married. Will that be a good thing? Would it be a good thing for me? Would it be a good thing for the other person? Would it be a good thing for any possible children we might have in the future? Will it honor God? We need to be constantly asking these questions. What are the implications of this? Isaac didn't do that. He simply let things take their natural course. He let Esau just get on with marrying whomsoever he pleased. And it brought great grief to him and to his wife, Rebekah. And if we're not constantly asking that question and constantly thinking through things beforehand, we too will find all kinds of things in our lives turning out to our great grief, as Isaac and Rebekah did. So that was one instance of him being unwise. Then the other instance of him being unwise is this proposal that he makes to Esau in the first four verses of chapter 27. And so we read, don't we, that he is getting old and he summons his son Esau to him. And we read in verse 2 then, he says to him, I am now an old man, I don't know the day of my death. Go and get your weapons, go to the open country, hunt some wild game, prepare me the kind of tasty food I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my blessing before I die. Now, quite apart from any other consideration, this was a highly irregular proposal that Isaac was making to Esau. Because, you see, it was the custom in those days for a dying man to summon all his children, to gather all his children around him, and to bless them all. That's what Jacob himself will do when he eventually comes to that point in Genesis 49. He'll gather all his sons to him. I suppose he doesn't exactly bless them all. He actually curses some of them. But he does at least address each of them in turn. And so there is something highly irregular in and of itself in this proposal that only Esau should be summoned and only Esau should be blessed by his dying father. But of course, in this case, it was worse than that. Because Isaac must have known what the Lord had said to his wife Rebekah back in chapter 25, verse 23. Remember how the Lord had said to Rebekah back then, when Jacob and Esau were still in her womb, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older, that is Esau, will serve the younger, that is Jacob. In other words, Isaac must have known that the Lord had already foretold quite unequivocally that Jacob was going to enjoy the supremacy out of these two brothers. Isaac must have known that. He must have known that the Lord had announced, the Lord had foretold that Jacob would enjoy the supremacy. And when, therefore, we see him proposing here that Esau can sneakily come to him while Isaac's an old man and almost dying, Esau come and Esau be blessed. It's effectively Isaac trying to defy and override the Lord's purposes and the Lord's plans. The Lord had purposed and planned that Jacob would be the blessed one of the two sons. Isaac is trying to engineer here that Esau will actually be the blessed one. And again, it raises the question, doesn't it? Why is Isaac acting like this? Surely a man like him should have known better. What was it that so spectacularly clouded his judgment on this occasion? And I think there's a very simple answer to that. In a word, idols. Idols. And I don't mean idols in the caricatured sense of metal or wooden things with faces and so on that you literally bow down to. The kind of idols that we generally associate with Old Testament times. I mean idols of the same kind that you and I still struggle with today. For one thing, there was Esau himself. I think Esau had become something of an idol to Isaac. And that was, I think, why he was so determined, in spite of everything, in spite of what the Lord had said to Rebecca, in spite of everything, he was so determined to bless Esau, so determined that Esau would receive the blessing. Esau had ascended to a place of too great a prominence in Isaac's affections and in Isaac's view of the world. He'd become an idol to him, and that, of course, is still a great danger that we must always be very wary of. There's still a great possibility of our children becoming idols to us, our children occupying too high a place in our view of the world. It's very interesting in those letters of Simon Rutherford. I quoted him this morning in his sermons, but in his letters, he writes often to this one particular correspondent who was a woman who had a child. And often at the end of his letters to this woman, he would refer to that sweet child whom you have borrowed from God, or that sweet child that God has loaned to you. Interesting terminology, isn't it? And it's a helpful antidote, I think, to that temptation to idolize our children. Always to remember, they are alone. They are something that we are borrowing merely, a gift from God. But I think that in Isaac's case, there was actually something, another idol, that even lay behind Esau. And it may sound ridiculous, but I think it was nothing less than his stomach, food. It's interesting, isn't it, how prominent that is in the narratives concerning Isaac. If you go back to chapter 25 and you read in verse 27, the boys grew up and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And you get the impression that Rebekah simply loved Jacob, whereas Isaac loved Esau because he really loved wild game so much, because he was being driven by his appetites, by his stomach. And here too, in this proposal that Isaac makes to Esau in these first four verses of chapter 27, he's not simply proposing, is he, that Esau come and he will bless him. He's proposing that Esau come and bring a meal with him, and then Isaac will bless him. Now, don't misunderstand me. There's nothing wrong in enjoying our children. Indeed, as Christians, we ought to enjoy our children. There's nothing wrong in enjoying food. As Christians, we ought to enjoy food. But it's when these things begin to cloud our judgment. It's when these things begin to muddle our thinking. It's when these things begin to put our thoughts out of sync with God's thoughts, our purposes out of sync with God's purposes, our plans out of sync with God's plans, our agendas out of sync with God's agendas. It's then, I think, that these things are in very real danger of becoming idols to us. That's what happened to Isaac. And whenever that is happening to us, we must sing with William Cooper, "The dearest idol I have known, whate'er that idol be, help me to tear it from thy throne and worship only thee." So that's the first thing we see then in this passage, an unwise man. But secondly, we see a powerful temptation. A powerful temptation in verses 5 to 17. And the temptation I'm referring to is the temptation that Jacob faced in this passage. The temptation to hijack his father's proposal by pretending to be Esau, and so take from Isaac the blessing that was intended for his brother. And this temptation then comes to Jacob through his mother, Rebekah. We read, don't we, that Rebekah had been eavesdropping. She'd been listening in to this conversation between Isaac and Esau. And having heard then what was said between them, in verse 8, she says to Jacob, "Now, my son, listen carefully and do what I tell you. Go out to the flock and bring me 2 choice young goats so that I can prepare some tasty food for your father just the way he likes it. Then take it to your father to eat so that he may give you his blessing before he dies." And just before we move on, isn't it a very important thing to remember that so often temptation does come to us through those who are closest to us and through those whom we trust the most. Was that not Adam's experience in the Garden of Eden? Who was it that suggested to Adam that he should eat the forbidden fruit? Was it not his own wife, Eve, the woman that God had given to him? And was it not the experience many centuries later of Jesus Christ? To whom was it that Jesus once had to say so sharply, "Get you behind me, Satan"? Was it not his own closest friend, Peter? And that was Jacob's experience here. The temptation came to him through his own mother, this woman with whom he had such a close relationship, this woman whom he would have trusted so much. And it'll be our experience often too, that temptation will come to us through those who are closest to us and whom we trust the most, whether it's our husbands or our wives, whether it's our parents, whether it's our elders, whether it's our Sunday school teachers. Now that's not to say that these people are evil. Peter wasn't evil. He was very well-meaning when he said what he said, which produced Jesus' rebuke. And Rebecca, well, she was certainly a devious woman in this passage, but I think generally she was probably a fairly commendable and godly mother. But you see, even well-meaning people close to us can become channels of temptation, and we must remember that. But we must ask the question here, what precisely was the essence of this temptation? What precisely was this temptation that Jacob was faced with from his mother? And the answer is this. It was the temptation to acquire something that was really and rightfully his, but to do so by an unworthy means. It was to acquire something that was really and rightfully his, but to do so by an unworthy means. Because you see, this blessing that Rebekah wanted Jacob to go and take from Isaac, that blessing was really and rightfully Jacob's. We've already said, haven't we, that back in chapter 25, verse 23, the Lord himself had promised, the Lord had foretold that Jacob would be the blessed one of these two boys. It was the Lord himself who had said, "Jacob will be the object of my blessing." And so this blessing It was, as I say, really and rightfully Jacob's possession. But, you see, rather than wait for that blessing according to God's timetable and according to God's ways, Jacob was here being tempted to grab it now. And to grab it now by deceit. To grab it now by exploiting his vulnerable father in his old age and in his loss of eyesight. He was being tempted to grab it now by cruelly tricking his own father. That then was the essence of this temptation. To acquire what was really and rightfully his, but to do so by an unworthy means. And of course, Jacob yielded to this temptation. Now, I said last week that Jacob is a fulfillment of the first great promise of redemption in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. That wonderful promise that the seed of the woman would crush the seed of the serpent. Jacob is a fulfillment of that verse, because as we see him throughout his life gaining the supremacy over Esau, as we see him gaining the victory again and again over Esau, we are seeing a tiny little glimpse of what that verse in Genesis 3 was talking about, the seed of the serpent being crushed under the feet of the seed of the woman. But they are only glimpses. Jacob is not the great final skull crusher that is promised there in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. He doesn't have the credentials to be so. He's not up to being so. And this passage is a fine example of that. This passage is telling us very clearly that although Jacob, yes, in a kind of shadowy sense, is a fulfillment of that verse, he is not the final skull crusher. But you see, many centuries later, someone else would step onto the stage of history. And one day, he would find himself in a desert, in a wilderness. And he too would be tempted to acquire what was really and rightfully his, but to do so by an unworthy means. I'm talking, of course, about Jesus Christ and the way in which in Matthew chapter 4 we read that on one occasion the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you, the devil said to Jesus. Now, what the devil was showing Jesus was really and rightfully his. We know that from the Old Testament, don't we? Psalm 2. God promises Jesus all the kingdoms, all the nations of the earth as his inheritance. These kingdoms and their splendor were really and rightfully his. But the devil here is tempting him to acquire those kingdoms by an utterly unworthy means, by doing something obscene, by bowing down to him. All this I will give you if you will bow down and worship me. But you see, unlike Jacob many centuries earlier, Jesus Christ didn't yield to that temptation. Jesus Christ resisted it. And Jesus Christ waited. And he waited patiently to acquire the blessing that God had promised him in the way that God wanted him to acquire it, which was by a terribly excruciating and agonizing way, by dying on a cross. Jesus didn't yield to the devil's temptation, but went all the way to the cross to acquire the kingdoms in the way that God wanted him to. Isn't it wonderful this evening that our salvation doesn't ultimately depend upon Jacob? Yes, in Jacob we can see some exciting little foreshadowings of our salvation, some little glimpses of its character. But thank God that we're not depending upon this man Jacob. This man Jacob who resisted, so who yielded, so easily to the temptation that came from his mother to deceive Isaac, his father. Thank God that our salvation depends on Jesus Christ, who didn't budge an inch as Satan himself tempted him, but who resisted and resisted and acquired the blessing in the way of perfect, unswerving obedience. So we've seen an unwise man, we've seen a powerful temptation, but thirdly, a gracious God. A gracious God. Because in many ways, what we have in this passage is a repeat, isn't it, of what we had in last week's passage, in Genesis chapter 25. And indeed, Esau himself is alert to that fact, isn't he? He says in verse 36, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? He has deceived me these two times. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." And as I say then, what we have really is a repeat of Genesis 25. Again, we have Jacob behaving atrociously. There in chapter 25, we have him being so brutal and so mean toward his brother Esau, refusing to give him any of his stew when Esau came in from hunting, so starving, so famished. He refused to give him any stew. And not only that, but he wangled this deal whereby he took Esau's birthright at a moment when Esau was so vulnerable because of his hunger. And yet, he came out with the blessing. He came away with the birthright. He came away with the status of the firstborn son, with all the inheritance rights. He had behaved atrociously, but came out with the blessing. And here again, we have the same thing, don't we? Jacob behaving atrociously, deceiving his own father, lying to his father, pretending to be someone else, just taking his father on a ride, behaving atrociously, and yet again he emerges with a blessing, because in verses 27 to 29, Isaac does indeed utter this benediction to Jacob. "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of heaven's due and adverse richness. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed and those who bless you be blessed." And it raises the question, doesn't it? How come? What's going on here? How come Jacob keeps behaving atrociously and yet emerging with God's blessing? Well, the answer, surely the only answer that we can really come up with is this, because that is what God had purposed. God had purposed to bless Jacob. That's, as we've seen again and again, that is what he had announced while he was still in the womb. The older will serve the younger. He had purposed right back then, and indeed, of course, before then, he had purposed that Jacob would be blessed, that Jacob would be the one who would be the object of his blessing. And so, even though we keep seeing Jacob sink into trough after trough of sin and shame, every time we see him emerge and emerge and emerge again, the object of God's blessing. Indeed, even the way that this narrative is written emphasizes, doesn't it, that this is God very deliberately doing this. It's a fascinating narrative, isn't it? And it has you on the edge of your seat, because you keep thinking, as Jacob is there in this encounter with his father, you keep thinking he's going to be found out. The way in which he goes in verse 18, and he says, "My father," and Isaac replies, "Yes, my son, who is it?" And Jacob tells him that it's Esau and why he's come. And then Isaac already is suspicious, isn't he? You expect that this old man is going to be a bit of a pushover, but he's not. He's suspicious immediately. He asks his son, "How did you find it so quickly, my son? He wasn't born yesterday." And then, of course, that leads Jacob into even worse sin. He lies then, doesn't he? And he almost blasphemes God. "The Lord your God gave me success." And then, still though, after that, Isaac is so suspicious. "Come near so I can touch you, my son, to know whether you really are my son Esau or not." This man really does have grave misgivings about who this boy is before him. And then we're told, aren't we, that he says, "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. He did not recognize him. And there's so much suspense here. And you think it's inevitable. You think that Jacob's going to be found out here. Isaac is so suspicious. But he isn't. And even then, at the end, of course, we read that after Isaac finished blessing him and Jacob had scarcely left his father's presence, his brother Esau came in from hunting. It's almost as if there were seconds in it. If Esau had just come a few seconds earlier, the whole thing would have been uncovered. But you see, God was working this, all the precise details of it, because God had purposed to bless Jacob, and God was going to make sure that Jacob came out of there blessed. Jacob wasn't going to be found out. Esau wasn't going to march in the middle of the whole thing. God was working all this down to the finest details. And isn't this our own experience? Why is it that we, this evening, sitting here in this church, are such blessed people? How is it that we can read Ephesians chapter 1, verse 3, and apply it to ourselves? God has blessed us in the heavenly realms with every spiritual blessing in Christ Jesus. How is it that even though our lives are so messed up, we're still so blessed? How is it that we, even though we keep sinking into trough after trough after trough of sin and shame, we still emerge every time with God's blessing as saved men and women, as those who are adopted into His family and justified with a righteousness that is Christ Himself and heading for glory? How is it? And the answer is the same, isn't it? God has purposed it. That's the difference between us and all those out there who aren't blessed. That's the difference between us Jacobs and all those Esau's. The difference isn't that we are somehow a different class of people, a different quality of people, a more superior race, a better type of person. Far from it. The difference is that God has purposed to bless us. Shouldn't it humble us tonight? This God of all grace. Why is it that there is a church in this world? That there ever has been, that there was back then in Jacob's day, that there is still today. Why is it that there's any spiritual life at all in this fallen world? Why is it there's any hope at all? Why is it there are any Christians? Why is it that there is anybody who worships the true and living God? Because some people are natively better than others? No, because God has purposed to bless them, and He'll bless them no matter what. It's astonishing. Illustration, an example that we see here of this wonderfully gracious God. So an unwise man, a powerful temptation, a gracious God, but fourthly and finally, a painful lesson in verses 41 to 45. Now, we know, don't we, and we must always be very careful to insist upon this, that not all suffering in our lives, not all adverse circumstances and adverse experiences in our lives is a result of something we've done wrong and is necessarily God chastening us. We must say that. We mustn't have this attitude that when something goes wrong, I must have done something and God is dealing with me because of that. But of course, on the other hand, the Bible does teach very clearly that God is a father and God does chasten His children. And I think we have an example of that at the close of this passage in the experiences of Isaac and of Rebekah. I think we have an example of that famous principle that was articulated by C.S. Lewis, that God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks to us in our consciences, but He shouts at us in our pains. Because here in these verses at the end of chapter 27, we see Isaac and Rebekah really going through the mill. Isaac, first of all, here he is and he has doted on this son Esau. He has devoted so much attention to Esau. He has focused himself on Esau. He has spent his life as a father, just pouring all his paternal affection into this boy Esau. He's invested so much time and so much energy and so much interest in this lad. But here now in verse 41, Isaac has to come to terms with the fact that the boy he doted on so much has turned into a monster. Esau, because of what had happened, he resolves, when the days of mourning of my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob. Isaac has to come to terms with this fact that the boy that he had put first in his life almost, certainly the boy that he had put first of his family, has turned into a murderous monster. And indeed we'll see next time that Isaac has to realize that it's Jacob who is the object of blessing, and he has to turn his attention really from now on to Jacob. And so here I think we have God shouting at Isaac in this experience of a son who has turned into a monster, shouting at him, you made an idol of that boy. You put him in a place he should never have had in your life. And now I'm going to force you to put aside that idol in the most painful way by realizing that the lad is nothing less than a murderous monster. But then we see in Rebecca's case something slightly similar. We see God shouting at her too, I think, because she too goes through the mill. She has doted on Jacob, of course. She has had this wonderfully close relationship with Jacob. And there's something, although you don't realize it at first, but you do if you know the whole story, there's something terribly poignant about verses 42 to 45. And the way in which she says to Jacob, your brother Esau is consoling himself with the thought of killing you. Now then, my son, do what I say. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay with him for a while until your brother's fury subsides. And then at the end of verse 45, why should I lose both of you in one day? And what's so poignant about that is, of course, that the stay with him for a while turns into the rest of Rebecca's life. Rebecca will never see her boy Jacob again. Jacob will go off to her brother Laban at Haran, and he won't come back while Rebecca is still alive. And she does indeed effectively lose both of them in one day. She loses Esau because he goes off as a monstrous murderer, and she loses Jacob because she'll never see him again. And again, I think God is shouting at her in her pain, and saying, you were a temptress to that boy Jacob. You led him to deceive and to exploit his father. And if it means me sending off your son and you never seeing him again, I'm going to bring you to terms with that and bring you to realize that and bring you to face up to your sin and to what you did to your boy Jacob. And so it's a very solemn end to the passage, really. Isaac coming to terms at last with his foolishness in doting upon Esau as Esau turns into a murderer. And Rebecca coming to terms with what she had done in leading Jacob astray as she now has to wave goodbye to Jacob, never to see him again. And sometimes, as I say, God will deal with us in this way. Perhaps you are going through experiences this evening. And as I say, I don't want you to just immediately come to this conclusion, God must be dealing with me because of something. But perhaps you do need to ask the question, well, is God saying something to me in this? Is he shouting at me at this? Is he bringing me to face up to something in my life in these experiences, as he was bringing Isaac and as he was bringing Rebecca to face up to things in their lives, in their pains? Well, may God help us to learn from that. Amen.